Rob Miller, joined by Chris Zellner for your monthly installment of Cover to Cover, the podcast that tackles wrestling magazines from our youth or current. We just haven't done any current. We probably won't, but from our youth, we'll say. What's going on, Chris?
Doing good. And yes, we won't be covering anything current for our sanity's sake.
Yeah, let's face it. Yeah. And plus, no offense to PWI that still exists, but man, the pickings are slim with current magazines. Seeing a current magazine is like seeing a unicorn. So,
well, I get one in the mail because I still contribute to Pro Wrestling Illustrated, so they send me one free in the mail.
Very cool. No, I'm glad they're still around and kicking. We picked a wrestler today that is from the Victory Sports Series After Mag family, London Publishing. The wrestler from December 1987. I didn't think it was December when I picked it. I thought it was like mid-87, but I guess it would be given the magazines came out like 3 or 4 months after.
Yeah, the cover date has like a 4 month difference.
Yeah, something like that. I never could really figure it out as a kid or now, let's face it. But the magazine is a picture of Hulk Hogan's face. He's wearing like a very 80s looking blue T-shirt with a bunch of, I don't even know how to describe the T-shirt, but it's an old ratty beat up magazine because, as I said to Chris earlier, I like that you could tell you read it a lot. A lot of my old magazines are pretty fucking piss poor shape, but this one isn't too bad. It still has a cover on it, which is more than I could say for most. I also had that habit in the late 80s and early 90s of cutting title belts off of the wrestlers in my magazines, which I've actually gotten used magazines with the same thing done. So I'm glad to see I'm not the only psychopath out there cutting and making little fucking belt collages. It's a wonder I wasn't like one of these belt mark dudes that go to shows with like title belts and stuff. I've never had a replica belt. I am very interested in like an actual belt. You know, I love the concept of owning a belt that was used in a match or that someone held. I love that kind of stuff. So if people are into that, hell yeah. If people are into the replicas, hell yeah. Like, fuck it. Who cares? Everyone likes different stuff. But that's not really for me, though, with the replicas. But I do think it's kind of cool. I know people really enjoy it.
Oh, man. I was at a show here, a WrestleAmerica show, where there's a guy who he always brought a book bag with him. And I've been seeing this guy at the shows, and we sat by each other one show, the way they had it set up, and we started talking. And he just started opening up his book bag, and he's like, yeah, you want to check this stuff out, what I got here. And he started pulling out belts. I mean, he had 3 replica belts.
And yeah.
Good-looking replica belts, too. He told me he bought them off High Spots. So, he had like about $800 worth of replica belts in this book bag. I'm like, Jesus.
Here's one of the things why I take umbrage with it. Back in the Ring of Honor days, like especially New York shows, fans, like tough New York fans, I say tough quotes in certain cases, I'm sure, but like, yeah, we're the champs, we have our belts, and they just would wear the belts and walk around the show. And you know, usually my little crew I'd be with would roll our eyes, but like, good for them. They enjoy it. That's how they go to shows. They have fun. They have their belts, and I think that's wonderful. My thing, though, is, golly, they're heavy. Like, I remember, like, every television taping and every house show we went to, my job was to take the NXT, not the NXT, yeah, the NXT or FCW titles. We kept them at the building, and then I'd have to take them and ensure that they went home with me after somebody forgot a belt one time. So for a period there, I had to take the belts to every venue or TV. One time a belt was forgotten, which really got me some heat at a television taping, but we got it. It was okay. But like, those things are fucking heavy and cumbersome, and you don't want to be traveling with them all the time. So like, people that bring belts to shows, God bless you, because that's a whole extra piece of shit you're carrying around the whole time. So could be good exercise. Who knows?
And not only did he have belts, he had his mask, and he would wear like a different mask every other match.
The fuck out. I like that.
Yeah,
he
had a La Parca mask, and he wore that, and then he fucking had a Pentagon Jr. mask. He would put that on, and then he put on Hayabusa mask. I mean,
one of my friends from Hamburg days of WWF in the 70s, he had a white mask, and he ruined it with ketchup on it, but he would wear this tainted mask to all the WWF. tapings, he would tell me, you know, I wasn't there, obviously, but, you know, he'd go and wear his mask and, you know, you wear your wrestler t-shirt or your homemade t-shirt mostly at the time. And fuck it. If you could have more fun making a big event out of it, go for it. But
see, back in those days, those guys, you know, in that era, they were advertising those Dr. X, you know, shirts and masks in the magazines, and dudes would buy them, and you'd see them. I know Mid-South, you see it all the time at Irish Mules Boys Club. There was a guy or a couple people there that would be wearing them and stuff. So, yeah, it was a big deal, even all the way back then.
Yeah, I'm convinced my friend had the Dr. X mask.
Yeah.
And he put the ketchup on it because everyone – backyard wrestling started in Shamokin. I don't give a shit what anyone says. We are the innovators of backyard wrestling, for better or worse. I'm saying it. I don't know if it's true, but I'm going to say it. So this magazine on it, big thing that says still only $1.75, which was huge because to me as a little kid at the time, it was so much easier to convince usually my dad to buy me a magazine for $2, under $2, than it would be to buy one for like $3 or $4, you know? And that's when the gaming magazines, the Electronic Gaming Monthly and things of that nature, when the early 90s, you know, they were all very expensive. And I'd still get all those. God bless my parents, because a lot of it was either allowance or whatever. But I would get these magazines. But back in the day, $2.25 and $1.75 was the standard. And I think Wrestling Main Event, which was the all slick paper magazine, I think that one was the big $2.75. So, but well worth it.
Any guess on what $1.75 would be in 1987 would be in 2021 money?
Oh, I don't got a fucking clue. I'm going to say $4.
You're very close. $4.15.
Hey, look at that. $4.15. And our Canadian friends, what's up, Rob O'Connor? $2.25 in Canada. So they always got, we put the boots to them with the less expensive price for the magazines back in the 80s.
Absolutely.
But we demand Ric Flair must wrestle UWF champion Steve Williams now. Okay. Rude, Bigelow, Gang, DiBiase, Hulk Hogan. Will he be drowned in the new wave of challengers? Ooh, exciting. And then they battled in the King Lawler's court, but Kurt Hennig still wears the AWA crown. So there you go. That is all the cover stories. You open up the first page, says, be a locksmith, make up the $26 an hour. Bunch of fucking rich-ass locksmiths from the 80s. $26 an hour in the 80s. My God, these people, you talk about inflation and the dollar increasing. Okay, so we're going to keep going.
Those were in every fucking magazine, basically.
Be a locksmith. Yeah, locksmiths. I wonder how many people that were wrestling fans got into the lucrative locksmith trade back in the day.
You would think a lot of them, because they advertise like shit.
Better to do that advertisement than buy a whole bunch of fucking sea monkeys or something. But
yeah,
that's on the back page. We'll get to that later. Your letters. Send your letters to Rockville Center. And the first one you're going to love. Drugs aren't chic. About 2 weeks ago, I met the Iron Sheik at Gold's Gym with one of my friends. I thought he was the greatest. Then in your September 1987 issue, I read about him and Duggan getting involved with drugs. I'm with Hulk Hogan's fight for the truth, not people who already lost the battle of drugs. Suspend the Sheik for life. Donna Neal from Fayetteville, Georgia. What a timely thing this is. So yeah, they're really upset that they got caught with marijuana and a little cocaine in, on the Garden State Parkway. Duggan and Sheik. I remember as a kid, it fucking tore me up because I realized A, wrestling's fake, and B, that no good Iron Sheik was palling around with my favorite Hacksaw Jim Duggan. But then I didn't give a shit by like the next week. However, at the time, it was legitimately in the local newspaper where I lived.
Dude, it was all over. I mean, you want to talk about a major wrestling news story nationwide? That was. And I do a lot of newspaper research and stuff for, you know, finding results of shows. And when you enter like Duggan or Sheik in 87, you get so many results from just everywhere, national services, local. I mean, that was a huge fucking deal. And yeah, it was always talking about, well, Duggan's a good guy and Sheik's a bad guy and they're feuding with each other. I mean, that That's a story right there that, yeah, it gets talked about a lot, you know, today about, you know, how it was. But I could only imagine what Vince McMahon was thinking when that hit the media and stuff. Like, oh, my fucking Lord. You know, I mean, yeah, WWF was starting to inch into the whole sports entertainment thing. But still, 87, they're still kind of treating it as a real thing. They haven't, you know, gone in front of New Jersey, you know, State Athletic Commission and admitted that it's fake. I mean, they haven't done that yet. So, I mean, this is 2 years before. And yeah, this.
Now, imagine if it happens before Mania 3. Because it happens shortly after.
God. Oh, God.
Imagine that.
Oh,
yeah.
Jesus. Absolutely.
That's the days of one big show. So it's like, that's something I don't think gets talked about enough. But like, holy shit, that would have been interesting to see. I don't think it really would have mattered, but still.
It wouldn't have mattered, but man, it would have been a major, major story. You know?
Yeah. You remember the Sheik, Volkoff, and Duggan had heavy juice angle.
Absolutely.
And I'd like to get a perfect copy of that. I don't know if that's on the network or anything, but I remember as a kid, Juice was not on the Saturday morning TV show too often, and Duggan got heavy juice and just brawled with Sheik and Volkoff, and he paraded up in the stands, I think.
It was at one of the hockey arenas, and he got on top of the board, and, you know, with the fans, a great visual, bloody and shit, and he got over on that, and he had some momentum, and then that happened, and yeah, you know, he came back, but he was never the same.
Yeah, and like that's the thing too, because you look at an angle like that, heavy angle juice, you're a kid, you know, you think, oh God, you know, Duggan's gonna fight the Sheik and Volkoff, the blood. It's like, oh man, it'd be like as if Flair and Dusty were the fucking Laker game together, but it'd be like if you saw like Tully and Dusty pulled over on the parkway, you know, it's just a heated feud, and then immediately they get caught together. So that was kind of wild. And of course, Duggan's famous line, he called his wife after he got away home from the police station. He's like, hey, you think anyone's going to know? And she called him. She's like, everybody knows. Like, damn. But, yeah, God bless him. God bless Duggan.
Here's a big what if. You know, Duggan, he came to one of the UWF tapings, the Crockett UWF tapings, after all that happened, and was trying to get work. And they wouldn't hire him. Think about how different it was if they would have hired him.
Yeah, because that was right when they're about to sell the damn thing. And, like, I remember.
Well, it's already sold. Crockett charged in. So, and Dusty was booking and stuff. But, I mean, yeah, they felt Duggan was too, I guess it's still too fresh, the whole story. And they weren't going to bring him in.
And I guess Bruce Prichard says, and Duggan says this too, so it's accurate, I think. But, you know, just hang tight, because like Vince is like, they will never work for this company. This company's more than a pack of smokes and a blowjob. Says in the big meeting. Yeah. So like, you know, I guess when Duggan comes back, Hillbilly Jim in the middle of the locker room's like, Vince lied to us. He said they'd never be back. He's standing right over there. And Duggan's like, pulls him aside. Get over here. So there's Hillbilly surely thinking he could take Duggan's spot, I imagine, as the big bearded guy. But so the next thing here, outrageous weekend event coming to wrestling fans city near you, the National Wrestling Convention for Fans, Chris.
I remember reading about this, yes.
New York City, October 10th and 11th at Manhattan, New York. Tentative guests are Lou Albano, Blassie, David Schultz, the Haiti Kid, Ox Baker, Crazy Luke Baker, Ivan Putski, Killer Kowalski, and Lou Fez. In L.A. in November at the Ambassador Hotel, Albano, Putski, Baker, Victor Rivera, Dr. Jerry Graham, Red Bastien. In Washington, you got Bruno, Killer Kowalski, Baron Cicluna, the Nighthawk, Tony Atlas, Wendy Richter and Ox Baker, and then finally Philadelphia, near me at the time. I guess this happened January 88. Bruno, Larry Sharp, Bulldog Brower, DiNucci, Kowalski, and EWA Star. So this is crazy. This has to be the first time I've ever seen, or the earliest I've personally ever seen, a convention for fans outside of something like a Cauliflower Alley. You know, I'm sure maybe there were. This is the first time I can remember seeing it in this magazine.
Well, they had the WFIA conventions every year. You know, the Wrestling Fans International Association.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, those went back through the 70s. That's when Have you ever seen the video on YouTube, the one from Knoxville in 78 where Cornette's there receiving awards? And, I mean, they got Boy Pierce is there. I mean,
man, I've never heard of any of this. No, I need to show that to you.
They would go to a city every year and have their convention. And usually those cities would do the Eddie Gilbert, Tommy Rich angle, where Eddie turned on Tommy in Memphis. Remember the one where the blood? Awesome. That was during the WFIA thing. Because Eddie was part of WFIA, and he did, and they did the big angle that weekend. You know, with them there. But they were not the Ole turning on Dusty in the cage at the Omni WFIA convention. They were there for that.
I vaguely recall some of these things, but did they ever talk about these things in the magazines that we read?
Not in the Aftermax.
Okay, so that's why I don't credit them, I guess, because they're more like an insider thing.
Yeah, exactly. It was all guys that had bulletins and shit. And
that's cool.
Guys and girls, a lot of women. I mean, there were, I'm gonna say a lot of women, but there were women there. I mean, Georgie Ann Macropoulos. You remember Georgie Ann, right?
Of course, yes.
Yeah, she was a big part of that. Diane Devine. I mean, yeah, they had their fan clubs. And it's another thing. Fan club people was part of that. And, they would go to a city every year. And some territories really played it up. Like Memphis would play it up. Southeastern. Paul Bosch would. I mean, they went to Houston multiple times, and he played it up. So, yeah, they would play it up. They welcomed them with open arms. Absolutely. And they would come in, and, of course, every award they would give would be to that promotion, like Wrestler of the Year, Tag Team of the Year, you know, Announcer of the Year. You know, I mean, it went to that promotion. But, yeah, it was a great thing for the fans of that era, the smarter fans and stuff, and people that had, like, fan clubs that would be advertised in, like, the Kitzer magazines. To show up and you know, set up their little booths, and they would like have buttons and pins, and you know, have their newsletters, fanzines, or whatever.
Here's the question for you. I have to bust in here.
Yeah, go ahead.
I would not have wanted to be a smart fan in the 80s. I don't mind that I was in the 90s. I would have hated it in the 80s. What's your thoughts on that? I don't think I liked it.
I think it, in the 80s, it was probably a little more taboo, you know, because you were a very rare breed, you know, and I knew smart fans in the 80s, and it was tough, you know. I mean, it's just different because they're talking on a different level than you were. I mean, that's how I found, you know, I really found out what his fate from my family. But, I mean, it's tougher when you're, like, a kid and you're, like, at a pro wrestling show and you got these guys that are in their 20s or whatever, and they're, you know, talking insider lingo and said, that guy's going to job and this, that, and the other. And, you know, what are they talking about? So, it was different. It was different. And
I didn't get any of that shit till 93. Like, I knew it was fake and stuff like that, but, like, I was so insulated until I got the Observer in 93 that, like, then it was like, oh, okay. Like, even at live shows, you'd have guys talking about stuff near you at the Hershey Park Arena about all this happened on NWA last week, but not too much about the inside stuff. So I was pretty much insulated from all that. But, yeah, I just think as much as getting the Observer in 93 and learning about all the Japanese promotions and all the inside stuff, it kept me a fan for sure in the 90s. And, of course, wrestling got really popular then, too, so I probably would have stayed anyway. But, like, in the 80s, I just think it was so real and the heat was so intense. I think it might have ruined it a little bit for me. So I'm happy I wasn't.
I think for kids, definitely. See, Biggs, yeah. Biggs was fucking – I joke with him and pick at him about this, but he was reading newsletters. He was, like, 6-7 years old.
Oh my gosh, that's
why I joked with him that he was going to school, like a preschool and kindergarten, and giving all the dirt sheet news to all the little kids about, you know, what Carrie Von Erich's
Bischoff when he was like 12? Yeah. Wasn't he on the thing with Bischoff?
Yeah, yeah, something like that. And Carrie Von Erich's fake foot and stuff like that. And he was like 5, you know. I joke with him about that all the time. And he was going to the Arezzi conventions at 7 years old.
Holy shit. Well, there you go. See, it's different for everybody, I guess. Yeah, I was so insulated from all of it that I, because like stuff that even like Gordon Scazzari, I wouldn't know the Ole Amani. I don't know any of these people he knows sometimes. And then like I read up on it and I learn after the fact, Eddie Einhorn, like all these names are foreign to me. But now, obviously, now I read enough and know enough that I know the names now. But like, I remember maybe, what, 20 years ago, he would say names and I would be like, what? And then like, I get it now. But yeah, so there you go. He started earlier and read up on all that stuff and the Matt watches and things of that nature, where I was observer exclusive. And I got the torch too sometimes, but I was just like an observer reader in the 90s, from 93 onward at least. So
do you remember that kid, like when AEW was first starting, when they had their little press deals, that little kid that they had that would ask questions and shit and stuff? He was like 8 or 9 years old, and he would.
Yeah, there's a bunch of little kids now on YouTube and stuff that do like fan interview stuff. And like, I don't know if they're smart in theory, but they're just little kids. Like, oh, well, okay. Well, they're just like.
It's just different, yeah.
Yeah, they're all into it in a different way. But like with me, fucking A, I'm so glad in the 80s, my precious 80s, that I watched more wrestling now than ever. But
yes, I
know. What's happening? The Rougeau brothers beat the Hart Foundation at the Forum, but then that shit was reversed. But it was 20,000 fans, and it was riddled with controversy. Jimmy Hart tried to hit him with the megaphone, hit Brett. Raymond covers Hart, gets the pin. So again, this shit with the Hart Foundation losing matches and then keeping the belts happened almost every year of the 80s, I suppose. But the Rougeaus, man, the Rougeaus never won the belts. And I'll tell you what, I hope I'm not on my own little island over here. I fucking love the Rougeaus. I thought they were excellent.
I thought the heel turn, they were tremendous. Before the heel turn, they were a really good tag team, but they were kind of bland. But when they got that heel persona, the All-American Boys, they were fantastic.
Yeah, I liked them as good guys too, but
I liked them, but they were just kind of, you know.
Yeah, maybe not put the belts on them type good. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
like they were better than the Bees, but less than the Bulldogs. We'll say that. The Bees.
I mean, the Bees had the gimmick. And they had a little mask switching deal, so they had that going for them. But Rougeaus were a better working tag team than the Bees were. Yes.
See, the fucked up thing is, I think every single team in the world is always going to be better as heels. Like the Islanders, I thought were great baby faces. I thought they didn't need to turn, but they were an awesome heel team. The Bees turned on Hulk Hogan and put the masks on. I think the Bees would have been a better heel tag team.
Rock and Roll Express was always going to be better as baby faces.
Okay, Rock and Roll Express, the Rockers. Although the Rockers in Memphis were great as heels.
Yeah, heel fantastics. I can't see Bobby and Tommy.
I even put Bobby and Tommy ahead of Rock and Roll, because I remember when Ricky grew his beard out with that Axl Rose type thing in the late 80s, he was quite a sneering motherfucker. So I'm like, all right, I buy that. But yeah, you're right. Bobby and Tommy might be the only team ever that could just absolutely never be turned heel, because the Fabs could be turned heel, you know?
They were.
Yeah. Huh. No, that's a good, always good topics. We could bounce off a million of these things. Correspondence report. It's Chicago, Illinois. It's Dusty Rhodes, Nikita Koloff, the Road Warriors, and Ron Garvin against the War Machine and the Horsemen in a War Games match beyond at the UIC Pavilion. So this is a War Games after the Bash, which is unusual.
They had them. I mean, they just weren't talked about a lot, but they had them, you know. And the War Machine, of course, is Bubba.
Yep. And he always worked good with Garvin, so that's smart.
I always wanted to see those novelty War Games, like the one from Nassau, the night after, Starrcade. That whole card. You look at that card and compare it to Starrcade '87. That's the better fucking show,
dude. I was so excited when we walked, because NWA or the Wrestling Network got on Channel 9 or 11. And they would play the song, dun, dun, dun. I forget how, dun, dun,
the NWA
dun,
Pro, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's it. But like, they would play the song and they had like all the wrestlers fighting, but they were like digitized kind of, and it was cool. And they would run the card down for Long Island, the Nassau Coliseum. And it was all these unique matches. Even the War Games was really unique. Barry was in it.
Here it is. I'll run down the card for you. They did 11,500. It was Barbarian and Terry Taylor going to a 10-minute draw with Ron Simmons and Sting.
All right.
Larry Zbysko over Kevin Sullivan in 405.
Okay.
Bugsy McGraw, Boogie Woogie Man, and Mighty Wilbur beat Black Bart, Ivan Koloff, and the Warlord in 839.
Hell yeah.
Jimmy Garvin and Michael Hayes over the Jive Tones in 713.
All right.
Dr. Death over Rick Steiner in 1014.
Holy shit.
Sheep Herders over Lightning Express, Brad and Tim, in 1202. Nikita beat Eddie in a Russian death match. The Road Warriors over Ric Flair and Lex Luger by disqualification.
Holy shit.
And then War Games. Dusty, Ronnie Garvin, the Rock and Rolls, and Barry Windham over Arn, Tully, Luger doing double duty, and the Midnight Express.
1,000% a better show than Dark. I hope to God that was pro shot and it's sitting somewhere in that fucking Stanford, because holy shit, even with those shitty Nassau crowds, I guarantee you that had to be a great show.
That was their debut. That was the first show they ran in that building. Yeah.
I remember the pictures in the aftermags, but like, wow, what a fucking cool show. I'm glad we brought that one up, because you're just like me. That's the show, man.
Yeah.
Because again, that Barry Windham and Garvin and Rock and Roll and the War Games was so unique at the time, because you usually saw Dusty and all the burly guys.
Midnight's. Midnight's team with Arn and Tully.
Yeah, the Midnight's and Arn and Tully. Holy fuck, what a show.
Yeah.
And even that Lightning Express, Sheep Herders, the Roadies against Luger and Flair. Oh, it's just a sick show. What a cool – and even that opener with Sting and Simmons and the fuck was it?
Simmons and Sting against Barbarian and Terry Taylor.
It was a Sting against Barb and Terry Taylor. Great time. Good shit. I love that.
Yeah.
What else do I love? Oh, here you go. Flip the page. Dr. Death press slamming Rick Steiner. And Rick Steiner looks like a child here compared to Dr. Death. It's
and this crazy. is cool fucking Rick Steiner with the short.
Biker shorts. Hell yeah. Yeah. Biker shorts, no knee pads yet, little shitty Roderick Strong boots. And there they go. They're in the UWF and they said, "You asked us. My question's for Dennis Condrey. I'm a very big fan. I wish you would return to the NWA. Why do you and your new partner, Randy Rose, call yourself the Midnight Express when you constantly be compared to the other Midnight Express of Bobby Eaton and Stan Lane? As far as I'm concerned, Randy and I are the only Midnight Express. Even before Jim Cornette came along, we were the Express. So anything that came along after is only an imitation. I'm not putting down Bobby and Stan. They're both outstanding wrestlers. Make a good team. But Randy and I are, and always will be the Midnight Express. We're not afraid of comparisons." See, this is cool. It pretty much builds up the whole damn thing a year later, but yeah, I liked the new Midnight Express. I usually hate new things, like the bombastic Bob and bodacious Bart and all that shit later on. And like, you know, I was okay on the new Fabs. I know I shouldn't have been, but I didn't mind them even. But like the new Midnight Express, I was cool with. Not the biggest Randy Rose guy. I don't think he's bad, but I like them. I loved Dangerously and just brilliant. Once Arn and Tully bounce, how cool was it when the new Midnight show up and attack the old ones, or the original ones, we'll say.
One of the best angles of that era in the studios. Absolutely.
100%. I didn't have it on tape. I still might not have it on. I have like a fucking 3,000 DVDs all over the place. I don't think I have this on tape. But very good. Excellent angle. And I remember just reading about it, and they made such a big deal out of it. It just sucks that all the bookers changed and the feud never had any legs. But
oh, God, yeah. One of the biggest missed opportunities. Absolutely. And they did the angle, you know, a month before Dusty was removed from power because of the spike angle. And, man, yeah, I mean, that shit had so much heat. And, yeah, I mean, they could have done a lot of stuff with it. But, yeah, just fate, I guess.
My question is for Road Warriors. Would you two ever want to team with Hulk Hogan in a six-man? No matter what your answer is, I think Dusty Rhodes a better partner for you guys anyway. Mike Wade from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. "Don't make me laugh, kid," Hawk said. "That bleach blonde boob Hogan won't last 5 minutes. I guarantee he learned more about tag wrestling in one match with us than he's learned with all the bogus partners he's ever had." Animal added, "Hogan don't know the first thing about making tags. he'd be stupid enough to stay in the ring and try to win the thing by himself. And then me and Hawk would have to get in there and throw him out over the top rope so he wouldn't lose the match. This is the angle for Sting in the later on in the year. How funny is that? It's, maybe after it was booked. That's fucking crazy. It's two questions in a row that basically happened a year later. That's crazy.
Bleach blonde boob. Can you see Hulk Hogan? I mean, can you see Road Warrior Hawk saying that? Bleach blonde boob?
I don't see him saying it.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. It was the 80s. Like today, I posted that magazine where the Andersons called the Road Warriors the Road Glorias. And I'm like, the Road Glorias. It's such an 80s fucking thing. I was like, get out of here. Glorias. All right. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Thumbs up to Nikita, Sherry Martel, Shane Douglas, and Greg Gagne. Thumbs down to Paul Orndorff, Ted DiBiase, Wendell Cooley, and JJ. We'll do Sherry and Cooley. Sherry Martel, she was the women's champion, the AWA, but her challenges were limited. Meanwhile, Moolah has let the belt rot away at WWF. Wow. Talk about honesty. Seeing an opportunity, Martel signed with WWF in her first match, beat Moolah for the belt. Since then, she's defended on a regular basis against a wide range of challengers. I'd love to see who they were. She's even made a number of TV appearances, giving the title renewed visibility and respectability. Who better to lead the way than Sherry Martel? All right, there you go.
Her wider, I mean, she did defend a lot. I mean, like on the house show, she was way more active than Moolah was because Moolah was hardly ever around. But I mean, just to give you a glimpse, like Angie Minnelli, Velvet McIntyre, Moolah in rematches, Judy Martin, I think she defended against her a couple of times. Of course, Rockin' Robin. That would be later on. But I mean, Olympia Hartauer. Just, you know, different names. But yeah, I mean, she definitely defended Princess Jasmine. She definitely defended against, you know, different people. And was on the road at house shows when Moolah was. And Moolah was fucking defending the title in fucking independent shows in Florida in 86.
Moolah was fucking defending the belt. Here's the thing. Sherry came in as a good person, right? She was good when she beat Moolah, right?
At the beginning, yeah, she was. She
turned her.
Yeah, because it was in Houston where they did the title change. And yeah, she was a babyface at the beginning. But I mean, at that show. But I think she worked heel as soon as she was on television.
Yeah, she's so awesome. Definitely like the great heel. She's like top five woman
wrestler. Sherry, as a personality, is one of the best of her era. As a total personality.
100%. Thumbs down to Wendell Cooley. It happens with almost everyone, but we're not going to get any stronger. Each time our hearts are broken, thrashed into little pieces, and left glued piece by piece, but never fully repaired. As wrestling journalists and fans, we have come to recognize the signs a mile away. Sadly, it's happening again. Wendell Cooley, one of the finest young stars in the sport, a great role model for fans, is turning bad. Oh, shit, I love that phrasing. He's developed a huge ego, something Danny Davis and Ken Wayne have noticed as well. What a tragic development. Holy shit, I'm going to cry. What a sad little bit of writing that was.
He fucked up, too. They turned him heel. He went with a stud stable. He was really good at it. Because Wendell was kind of like that poor man's Magnum TA in a way, where he had that aggression. You know how Magnum was always aggressive as a promo and a babyface? Wendell was like that, too. And you could see where whenever they would turn – if they never decided to turn him heel, he would be really good at it. Well, he was really good at it. Problem was – in that territory, you make a shitload of money as a babyface selling 8x10s and autographs, shit like that. And when you're heel, it's not as plentiful. So he, if I remember what Bo James said, he lost like a few thousand dollars in like his first month as a heel. And he's like, I gotta go back. Please That's turn fun. Me back. And they turned him back babyface not very long after he turned heel. And they did a great angle in doing that, and which I won't go into that because it takes time to describe everything. Because back then, folks, they had nuanced angles in wrestling. But they turned him back babyface, and he became hot again, and went back to doing big business. Dude, those guys, just to give you a hint, Johnny Rich, 1 year, in just gimmick sales alone, made over $200,000 in that territory.
Johnny Rich?
Johnny Rich.
Holy shit.
In gimmick sales. Just gimmick sales. Not counting his pay. What he was getting paid to wrestle. That's just selling shit.
Do you think the Fabs made that much?
Oh, I'm sure they made great. And see, what would happen, too, is like they would have the heels would have merchandise, but of course the heels couldn't sell at the tables. So they would have people selling the stuff for the heels, and then they would give the heels their money. In some cases, the baby faces would give the heels some of their merch money. If the heels didn't have merch, they give the heels a percentage of their money, because, of course, it takes the heel to get the baby face over.
Good old territory days, guys.
I love it. I miss it. I miss it so much.
Introducing Sean Simpson. Don Simpson is a 17-year-old lad. Or no, 17-year-old Stuart Simpson is getting ready for his pro debut.
Oh, my goodness.
Sean is 18. And then Steve is like the oldest guy. But, yeah, Steve, Sean, and Stuart Simpson. Crazy how young everyone is. And it's, again, that Dallas thing. Where they struck gold were basically the Birds, the Von Erichs, Iceman, Chris Adams.
Steve was 23.
Jimmy Garvin. Yep. The Simpsons. Everybody was so fucking young. And they just pushed young. And it was like fucking – it just worked. And then everyone clicked. And the fucking – the production values were what they were. They had the music. Perfect storm of everything. And obviously, by the time Sean Simpson comes around, it's not the same. But, you know, it's still young wrestlers there in Texas. And I like the Simpsons. I like Steve Simpson a lot. I don't think I've watched a Steve – I'm burying myself here because I know I have comps of world class. But I don't think I've watched a Steve Simpson match since 1987. So I should probably work that out.
You need to you need to watch – if you're going to watch anything Simpson related – 1988, their feud with Tatum and Victory, where the Texas Stadium Show, one of them gets blinded by mistake with the Freebird hair cream.
Oh, no.
And Terry Gordy feels like he's responsible for that happening. So he had already just turned, basically, in a way. He got tired of the Freebirds fucking him in his matches, causing him to lose by mistake. So he turns babyface with the only people he works with. He tags with Sean Simpson.
I remember this.
It's great. And they had a really, really fun feud with Tatum and Victory. So
I remember reading about Gordy as like a big brother to Sean Simpson. I like that. That has that whole Lord Humongous Shane Douglas type thing going
exactly.
for it.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I would watch for the Simpsons. Absolutely.
Yeah. I'll check it out. Cause I have it on tape. It's been a minute. I got to reference this. The next page, Simpson armlocks Cowboy Tony. Okay, look. So I watched 1986 Memphis this week. You know, I'm about to bring up Boy Tony.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
There was so much stuff, Chris, that I like to take my clips and put them on Twitter and all. Some of it I couldn't even put up because I just know someone will get offended. And God bless them. I don't blame them. But like. Some of these things are so unbelievable. Like the Boy Tony thing. Now, I've seen the Boy Tony thing where he teaches people how to brush their teeth and use deodorant.
Yeah, that's a common deal. That's a common angle. Yeah, in that
But the one where he's just sitting in like Jeff Jarrett's grandmother's house and he's in a shitty room and it's all pink and he's in his little Boy George outfit and they have, of course, Karma Chameleon underneath. Unauthorized, they have it playing, and he's like, "I went to a Boy George concert, and he liked me. We became friends, and then he told me I could be Boy Tony, and we're gonna go on all the new tours." And like, it's such a shitty promo. It's
hilarious.
It's one of the worst promos I've ever seen, but one of the greatest promos I've ever seen because he has no real conviction. He's trying to remember everything Jerry Jarrett told him to say or Lawler, and he's just going and going and going, and it's like a fucking promo train wreck. But I fucking love it, and I It's just unbelievable.
Just wait till you get to the Tracy Smothers feud.
Ugh.
Because, oh my God, where Tracy Smothers, on live television, called him the F word.
Oh, no. Well, I remember as a kid, I loved Boy George, and I liked Dead or Alive and all of that stuff. And then Boy Tony came out, and I just saw a picture of, well, Boy Tony was a wrestler, and I saw a picture of him in the magazine. I was like, oh, man, Boy Tony, what's that? It's like Boy George. And then, like, finally seeing it, like, 35 years later, so unbelievable. But then I watched a Jimmy Garvin promo. Another thing I was going to put online, but he's like, Jimmy Garvin and Precious are at World Championship Wrestling, Tech Wood or wherever it was.
Is this the
and
Magnum, like, feud?
He's like, Magnum, no, it's even before it. But Dusty gave Magnum a kiss in a promo earlier, and he's like, oh, Dusty and Magnum kissing each other. You guys are some kind of sick individuals. And then, like, he's got a press with them, and then he's like, he goes, yeah, man, I they want to go. They do everything together. I heard Dusty Rhodes in the bathroom and Magnum went right with them. I don't know. And he looks right in the camera and says it. And it's completely horrific. And the cancellation times 12 that I posted. But, like, it's just one of these promos that is pure 80s and just ridiculous. And Jimmy Garvin's delivery on said promo, despite the content, was so perfect for a shitty heel in the 80s.
Oh, he was awesome in Croc as a heel. Jimmy Garvin
was fucking awesome, period. I watch a Jimmy Garvin shoot so often because I just love hearing him talk about wrestling. And Jimmy and Sunshine, and Jimmy and Precious, I'm going to work on it myself. I'm going to try to put a compilation together because I love it. He attacks Wahoo and brainbusters him on the floor.
Oh, the shit he talks about Wahoo. You talk about cancellation. Good God.
Yeah, hard eyes all over there. Yeah, I don't think he used the word Native American once.
It's no.
And, like, to me, that's in that day heat. Jimmy Garvin came up through Florida. He came up through a lot of the very uncouth blue style of speaking on promos. I'm like, holy shit. But yeah, man, Jimmy Garvin in 86, if Magnum's accident don't happen, that Magnum Garvin feud was going to be
hot. Magnum and Spanked Precious and the build, I mean, I don't know if it was Spartanburg or Greenville, but that place was going fucking insane.
Yeah, and Magnum throwing right hands at Jimmy, and Jimmy selling them, like, fucking ricocheting off the ropes. Oh, it was so good. They only had, like, two interactions, and they were both so fucking great.
And Jimmy talking about Magnum being a gay stripper in San Francisco and all this other stuff. Oh, it is amazing.
Those guys were going to have such a feud. And as I say that, I flip the thing, Q&A with Ronnie Garvin. Ronnie and Precious and Jimmy Garvin are all back together, and they're friends. And he's in the title chase with Flair. And it's like, this Jimmy Garvin shoot. They're like, well, do you get along with Ron Garvin? And he's like, well, he's like, you know, I don't hate him. And they're like, oh. And then he finally just says to Mark Nolte, he's like, well, let's just put it this way. If I never see Ronnie again for the rest of my life, I don't really mind. He probably thinks the same. I was like,
yeah, no. I've seen him late, you know, in later shoots, you know, I mean, he said that, you know, if they see each other, they're very cordial, you know?
Yeah.
There's no hatred or anything. They just, you know, we're not going to go out of our way to say anything. And remember, I mean, Ronnie was his stepdad. You know, Ronnie married his mother.
Yeah. It blew my mind as Jimmy was 14 and Ronnie was 22. And basically, when I was a kid, I grew up on Ronnie and Jimmy Garvin were brothers. So then finally, whenever the fuck I found out, it would have had to be after 1993 or 94. But, like, when I found out, like, Ron Garvin was Jimmy Garvin's stepdad, I was like, what? And then hearing Jimmy Garvin talk about it. And the crazy thing is, too many people probably don't do this, but I cage match Jim Garvin just to look up what his last matches were. Among Jimmy Garvin's last 20 matches was a match against the Ultimate Warrior. And also, his last matches was with Ron Garvin in the year 2000 for some loot thing against the fucking Rougeaux in 2000.
Yeah, they were doing the 15th anniversary of that feud. Yeah.
Yeah, so I never heard of that, but they did a couple matches, and I was very surprised. So I was like, all right, Jimmy Garvin, quietly going away. Because last thing I remember from him was he was at that Super Brawl 4, and he invented the 911, which is the Stone Cold Stunner, on Johnny B-Bad. But
he worked global. He was all three Freebirds was working global in 94.
Yeah, because him and Gordy teamed up a little bit. So, yeah. What a trip. And I like, turn the page here. Wahoo McDaniel. Wahoo's wrestling Boris Zukov. He looks old and out of shape, but Wahoo was always awesome till the end. And we've got the panel of Captain Lou, Killer Kowalski, Toru Tanaka, Larry.
Real quick, the best Boris Zukov match I ever seen was with Wahoo McDaniel. And the I think it was either Russian Chain or Indian Strap match from Vegas. You want to talk about blood? Jesus Christ. And that was on ESPN. I mean, those dudes were just gushing. And it was just Wahoo beating the shit out of Boris. Boris juicing. Really great shit.
I got to find that match because I love Wahoo just stiffing the shit out of people.
Well, he was great in that AWA run. You know, his matches with Curt Hennig was great, with Boris, the stuff with Manny, of course, fucking awesome.
Him and Greg against Adonis and Orton, I think. So,
yeah, really cool. Great run. He was the booker. So, yeah.
Yeah, I got to look into all that. I'm in a process of downloading all the TV from all fucking time, I think. So it's like
join the club.
Yeah. Or, I mean, getting DVDs of the tape, because like, you guys face it, that shit was on ESPN less than 10 years ago, so it's very available.
It's an ESPN classic, a lot of it. Yeah.
So okay, we got Toru Tanaka, so of course we have to hear what he has to say.
Yes.
Professor wrestled Indian slime many. Now, see, I gotta watch when I say these things. Okay, Professor wrestles hard eye slime many times in the past. I never impressed by him. He jumps around ring like wild hard eye, but he does not scare me very much. I am also not impressed by his chops. They look very painful, but they do not hurt at all. Many people say Wahoo McDaniel chop must be devastating. This is like I'm putting it back 20 years ago. What am I doing? But that not case. He is very easy man to defeat. I am surprised he is still wrestling. So there you go. So whoever wrote that, fuck you, he races. But it works for the 80s, I guess. I don't fucking know.
Bruno part of that group?
What's that?
Is Bruno part of that group?
No, it's Albano, Kowalski, Toru Tanaka, Jack Briscoe, Lou Fez, and Larry Henning. And it's the picture of Jack Briscoe. Got like this Dorothy Hamill haircut.
Oh, it's the 70s Jack?
Yeah, they didn't do him justice with that
photo. Oh, too bad Bruno wasn't in there so we can get a doggone it.
Doggone it, Wahoo. So now we got to do Kowalski too. Hopefully he doesn't say anything too offensive here. I've got something to say about Wahoo McDaniel, and it ain't all complimentary. He's just like all the others, a lazy. I can't believe this guy is still in wrestling. Jesus Christ, this is amazing. Is still in wrestling after all these years because he's never had it and never will. You know, they say he's never lost the strap match, but he's nothing but a liar. I happen to know for a fact he's lost one of them strap matches because I saw it with my own eyes. All right, we got to get away from it. So, okay, so the bad guys don't like Walking with Daniel. Battled in King Lawler's court, but Curt Hennig still wears the AWA crown. And, okay, so Curt beats Bockwinkel, and he comes to Memphis, of course, to wrestle Jerry Lawler all the time. So here they are. They have an exchange of backdrops and hip tosses, chin locks, and all this kind of stuff. And, oh, shit, there's a picture of a woman pile-driving Jerry Lawler. It's a beautiful photo, but that ain't no woman. That's Brickhouse Brown. Oh, shit. At the end of the match, Lawler is pile-driven by Brickhouse Brown, who tried to disguise himself as a woman from the crowd.
That was the Black Prince era Brickhouse Brown, where he had Don Bass and Carl Fergie, where Carl Fergie was the real king. You want to talk about it? 87 Memphis is such a wild trip because you start with the year with Idle Rich feud with Lawler, and the television is so odd to watch because the syndicated shows, which is mainly what we have of that era online and in the tape trading world, is you don't see as much of that feud because that was mainly a Memphis feud, so they should. So what you got on syndicated shows was everything else that was going on in the territory, which, you know, whether it be Jeff Jarrett and Billy Travis feuding with Paul Diamond Pat Tanaka or, you know, all these other stuff going on. Then when Island Rich and Lawler ends, Dundee comes back. Then you have George Barnes coming back in after being gone for 10 or 12 years, feuding with Dundee. Rocky Johnson's in. And then you have the Brickhouse Brown stuff. So you have that angle. And then that dies down, and then you start, you know, the Midnight Rockers come in, Nasty Boys are in, and that's when Bobby Jaggers, Manny Fernandez, Jimmy Jeff Funk, and all these guys come in. It's like, it's really fun watching Memphis, you know, how it progresses, you know, every 4 months or so to something completely different. And
sometimes every couple weeks. I'm watching Sticks, and like, for about 2 months, JD Costello was all over the fucking TV. Like, I probably hadn't seen more than 2 JD Costello actual videos prior to this. I now feel like I'm a JD Costello aficionado. So much. Fire and Flame, the Mod Squad. I'd read about all this as a kid, but it's all over every single time.
You definitely can tell that his idol was Jim Cornette.
Yeah, but then also he looks like a combination of Madam from Solid Gold, if you take Quentin Tarantino, and it's just such a mindfuck for me.
Wailing Flowers and Madam, I love it.
Yeah, a little bit, but he's great. I like JD Costello when I was a kid. You know, I didn't see him on the show ever, but I'd see him in pictures with the Mod Squad. I thought he was cool. But he's all over the show. It's just so wild, like you said, just all the different stuff. And you said something that blew my fucking mind, so I'm going to drop it on you here. They had a syndicated TV show, too? They didn't just have, like, the Saturday morning Memphis show? Did they have more than one show?
All right, so the Memphis show was 90 Minute Live, okay?
Okay.
So the other markets, Louisville, Nashville, Evansville, wherever else, they got the 60-minute version of that show. So it's 30 minutes cut, and then they would have localized promos for those markets where they would tape them at the Mid-South Coliseum. And sometimes you would have situations where if the Memphis show had a lot of shit going on Memphis-related, they would either show a match or something from one of the other buildings, or they would – like show an old match or something, or videos. Yeah, they're totally different shows in a way. I mean,
because here's the thing.
Yeah.
I cannot stand, and I'm going to get fucking hate tweets forever for this, I cannot stand the WMC studios. Like, I don't think I've ever enjoyed a match there. Like, it's just quick squashes, usually really sloppy, usually people probably shouldn't be in a ring sometimes. It just was done to push and progress the shows. I'm watching it all. Like, I say I can't stand it, but I'm watching it religiously, so I probably am liking it.
Those shows are all about the angles more than the matches.
Yeah, but, like, I feel like then even the Mid-South Coliseum, the lighting is all fucking dark. I just wish Memphis had a satellite show that was taped somewhere else than either the Mid-South Coliseum or that weirdly lit little building studio tapings, because when you're a kid, you have these pictures of, oh, well, you know, it's going to be Pastrnak and Paul Diamond against Jeff Jarrett and Billy Travis, and they're going to be at this big arena, and they're going to kick ass and cool bumps, and you visualize all this shit. And even in the pictures in the magazine, it looks cool. But then when you actually see it on tape, when you see the Mid-South Coliseum, you know, that sometimes there's better lighting than others. I don't really understand why that is, but, you know, it is what it is. But there's always been a thing where I love Memphis wrestling for the creativity, the angles, the way they would turn things over, everything you said. But it's hard for me to get really invested in any of the in-ring stuff because it's either let's just run through it on a studio taping. I mean, aside from like Flair and Lawler when they had their 85 match, and there are times where it does get hot in the studio. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to shit on it, but I just watched so much Uncle Elmer. You know, it's a lot of stuff that I didn't enjoy. So I'm trying to find the sweet spot. Maybe it's 87, like you're describing, with like Manny and Jimmy Jack Funk, and you know the Guerreros are coming in, and it's just Eddie Gilbert comes in 88, and you know that whole clique. And I personally always lean toward Idol and Rich against Lawler and Dundee and Bigelow. So that's kind of what I'm getting into watching now too. And like I said, I'm all over the place here, but it's one of those promotions I wish I enjoyed way more, and I only really could blame the aesthetics because I think that's the only thing that's kind of doesn't get me fully invested to watch a ton of it.
But that's I can understand. I can understand that. I can understand that, but the studios is kind of the appeal.
Yeah, because I don't like World Championship Wrestling. I've been trying to watch World Championship Wrestling because that's all that's on the network, and it fucking enrages me, Chris. Because you know this more than anybody. You really do. I have all the world minds. And I really love all the Worldwides. But I want the Worldwides from 1985 and 86 and 87 in perfect quality, in that pristine quality where you hear the crowd crisper. You know what I mean? And the music will be gone, so that'll suck. But, like, ideally in the next couple of years, I want that shit, that Worldwide stuff where the heavy angles, the loud crowds, Spartanburg, the gymnasiums. That's my shit. I can't get as invested watching the studio stuff. You all grow up on that. I didn't have TBS, so, like, I'm tougher with it.
Yeah, it's hard exactly. for me to watch. It's understandable. I understand.
Yeah, so like I'm not shitting on anything here, but I'm just saying for me to enjoy studio wrestling, it's hard for me. It's hard for me to do it because like I like when you watch the NWA with the screaming girls and the hot crowds in Spartanburg, and you can just tell the building's like 1,000 degrees, but everyone's into it. And the wrestlers are vibing off the energy of the fans. I can't then just go to a studio and watch a Jive Tones match. It's just not the same. So it's hard for me. But that's my little Memphis soliloquy, because I watched tons of it this week. I'm not saying I hate Memphis by any means. It's just, in my opinion, I would enjoy it more if it was prettier and had like a Cobb County arena as opposed to a studio. But that's because I liked it when they moved. You remember this. They moved. I guess they moved to Mid-South Coliseum in 88 with the Renegades Rampage tapings, you know? And
well, that's AWA. Those were AWA shows. Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of liked the AWA when they went away from the Showboat, which I like the Showboat. But, you know, it's just funny. We could literally do 3 hours on, like, our favorite venues in the 80s to watch wrestling from. Yeah. But, like, I'm just saying it's harder for me to watch the studio wrestling, whereas some people, it's their sweet spot. Totally understand. It's not like I'm not watching it. It's just like I get more pumped for a primetime wrestling at the Garden with that ding, 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 ding.
Well, you know, one big difference in studio wrestling and in arena wrestling is more often than not, the studio wrestling, the fans are, you know, they got in free. In the building, they're paying to get in. So they're paying their money to get in, and there's a different type of enthusiasm, I think, in that regard, in a building where people have paid money to go see this show. That means they really want to see this. They spend their hard-earned money as compared to getting, you know, some free tickets in the mail to go see a studio show.
Yeah, it could be. I just also think the volume, though, too.
Well, there's that. But I tell you, I mean, there are eras there where some of these studio shows, you know, are just as hot as some of these buildings. You know, Memphis, mm-hmm. Memphis has those eras. I mean, it depends on what's going on, you know. But, I mean, in Tech, what? In the late 70s, early 80s? I mean, those are some hot crowds in that building doing the two upside your head. It's two upside your head. You know, we're Mr. Wrestling 2 and Go Tommy Go and, you know, all this stuff. I mean, they're getting red hot in this. It all depends on who's in the building.
Here's my thing for you. By the time I talk to you next, I'm going to give you a project homework. 10 favorite things you've ever seen on studio wrestling. And just let me know what it is. Think about it for a little bit. You probably have it on already, but you know. But like 10 favorite things, because for me, Rich getting turned on by Eddie Gilbert is clearly number one. That's like one of my favorite things I've seen on a studio wrestling thing. But yeah, I'd love for you to tell me more stuff that I could seek out that isn't, you know, just the week-to-week TV, which I'm going to keep watching. I love doing this journey of
1980. I can give you one automatically right now that you need to watch if you've never watched it. And I've talked about it on this show, I think. I've talked about it on mini podcasts. Tony Atlas and Kevin Sullivan against Ivan Koloff and Alexis Smirnoff from Georgia in 1980, around May 1980. And the whole angle where they use ether to put Tony Atlas out. And you want to talk about a crazy scene. That they go to a break after the match is over, and Gordon Solie is surrounded by wrestling fans. He's interviewing them, you know, talking about what was that they smelled. And they said, that was ether. And there's this one woman, she said, I am a nurse, and I know the smell of ether, and that was ether. There was no way around. I mean, just this crazy scene, you know, just Gordon surrounded by fans. And that's one that, because there was heat, man, there was heat on that one. So that's the one that just immediately pops in my head on that one. And Gordy, I just tweeted this the other day, Gordy returning to Georgia after him and Hayes feuded in Alabama. and saving Hayes from getting his ass kicked by Bustler, your Super Destroyer. Holy shit. Techwood about lost their fucking minds on that one. So that's two right there.
All right. Yeah, I'm going to look all this up. Because again, we will confer. I have a friend from college, and like he calls all wrestling studio wrestling. He's a dick. He's not really a big wrestling fan, but like he got obsessed with it because I forced him to like Nitro in the late 90s. He's like a sports guy, but like, you know, sports people can convert to wrestling fans. It's, they kind of get with it, but not really. So he's always like, hey, you still watch that fucking studio wrestling? I'm like, listen, man, leave it alone. I like wrestling. But yeah, this is like a new project for me. I'm gonna get into studio wrestling. You're going to help me do it. But wrestler exclusive, the man Barry Windham fears most. And it's a picture of Rick Steiner jacked as all fuck in a cool pair of biker shorts and knee pads, Irish whipping Barry Windham across the ring.
I'd be scared of 1987 Rick Steiner, too. That was a bad motherfucker.
Yeah, the crazy thing about this is Rick Steiner is so much shorter than Barry Windham. And you forget Windham 6'5". You don't think of Rick Steiner as a short guy, especially by today's standards.
Yeah, but Rick had that thing where he would get in that stance.
Yes. He was so stocky and like a spark plug where he would kind of bend knees a little bit more. And he's bending knees in all these pictures, so good call, Chris. But I like them a lot. That match they had, the clips of it on the, you know, this one, the War Games 87 DVD, man, the greatest lariat of all time in the NWA, where he hits the big Steiner line on Barry and just takes his head off. Yeah. But love this feud. I love Steiner at this point. I hear a lot of good stuff about Steiner's kid. I'm rooting for Steiner's fucking kid. Bronson Rick Steiner's going to be a monster.
Rick Steiner was in the news a lot lately. He's on he's on the school. Well, no, he's on the school board for one of the counties. I don't know.
Yeah,
in North Atlanta, and they had these really contentious school board meetings in the past couple of months about, you know, masks in schools, and like these angry ass parents were in there talking a lot of shit, and I'm thinking to myself, did they not know who that guy is sitting up there? That he could come down there, even though he's, you know, in his 50s now, or maybe or close to 60, could come down and just beat your fucking ass? You know?
Yeah. As someone who's worked in the news field and attended many a school board meeting and seen several real – I've seen school board members who are total heels, Chris, like complete heels. Like it's fascinating to me. Like, I won't say where who, but like some of these school board meetings are so catty.
And the parents are just, like, it was the parents. They were kicking parents out and stuff because they refused to wear masks in the building. It was mandatory and
yeah,
this and the other. And it's Rick Steiner sitting right there, you know?
Yeah, even pre-pandemic, they sucked, but I can't even imagine with the whole mask thing with everybody with that stuff. It's nuts. But, yeah, man, Rick Steiner and his kid now. His kid's only 5'11", which I was excited. Everyone's like, all these two big monsters down in NXT. His kid is a brick shithouse, much like Rick was in like 86, 87. So his kid, everyone's like, oh, he's going to be a star. Well, you know, there's a lot of guys that came from the NFL who have that natural intensity and that they could just hit that second gear. And that's what's missing with a lot of wrestling. So, like, I'm hoping that given he watched a lot of wrestling as a kid, like I hope Steiner's kid ends up being really good, because I'm rooting for him. I'm a big Rick Steiner fan, and if his kid is anything like he was in 86, 87, and 88, like...
Yes, Pop and his uncle had the intensity, that's for sure.
Yeah, shit, fucking hell. But what's your favorite year of Rick Steiner? That doesn't count 1988, because 88, I think, is all of our favorite year for him. Yeah, tough question.
91, maybe?
Yeah, I kind of lean toward 91, 92. I think once he had a lot of those shoulder problems and bicep issues, I think it wasn't the best. He was awesome in 85 and 86, just from a visual standpoint, where it looks like he literally has bowling balls taped to his fucking body.
When he's Buzz Sawyer's lackey. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, I liked him in his green years. He was a lot of fun. He just had that intensity, but he never looked too lost, and that's good on Rick Steiner, or Rob Rex Steiner, as they called him at the time. Mm-hmm. I guess everyone called him that at the time. But okay, so Rude Bigelow Gang DiBiase, or DeBuse. Hulk Hogan, will he be drowned by the new wave of challengers? So this magazine is convinced that Bam Bam Bigelow is coming in as a heel as well. because they got DiBiase in his original black, shiny with gray outfit and purple. One Man Gang, Rick Rude, Bam Bam Bigelow. You know, Hogan's 87 was wild, man. I guess this is post, he must have dispatched of Killer Khan.
87 is the last great Hogan year. As far as, like, of Hogan being that run, that's the last year. Because he becomes so much of a cartoon character after 87, it's insane. 87 is when it begins, but he becomes just like a total fucking cartoon character, you know, as 88 comes in.
Yeah, you know, he has these feuds with Boss Man and Earthquake later, but I agree with you on that one. Like, he still seemed to have... They seem to throw more opposition at him monthly then. Like, it seemed like he
has a variety of opponents in 87. Yeah. Harley, Gang,
Killer Khan, Kamala,
Orndorff, Andre, DiBiase.
Yeah, they did kind of keep him there. It's weird because, like, in 88, 89, 90, he had more money-making feuds, but it seemed like they were all longer-lasting.
It was all the same guys. Yeah, he was just programmed with the same. Or he was gone. You know, that was the time he started taking time off, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So here it is. They're saying these new crop of guys are going to come in. And this was a really fun time to be a WWF fan. 1986 kind of had a lot of long themes, and they had wrestlers coming in and out, don't get me wrong. But 87, you just saw so many new faces in and out of the WWF, and it made it very exciting, in my opinion, to watch. Because you had Patera coming back, Hercules, Rude, Bundy, Orndorff. That's just one contingent with the Heenan family. You had Andre, who's the big star, Hogan, Macho Man turning good, Jake the Snake turning good, Honky really developing his heel ways. There was just a lot of fucking stuff going on. Sika and Kamala still hanging around, Demolition debuts. Yeah, Gang, there's a million fucking tag teams, like legitimately at least 12 tag teams.
Demolition's really starting to go down.
Yeah. It was a good time, man. I'm gonna start finding more of those house shows from the Garden, Boston or Madison Square
Spectrum,
and the Spectrum as well, because I would watch them on Prism up here in Pennsylvania. So
always good fun shows. I love watching the Toronto Maple Leaf Gardens. Can't forget them.
Yes, the make believe gardens at some people.
And the ramp.
Yes, that fucking ramp is immortal. Here's the thing. Do you like 87 or 88 WWF better?
87.
Because they're kind of similar in ways.
I like 87 better, but I think 88 may have... 88 maybe has like the better angle. So you got all the... You got Jake and Rude in 88, and you got you know, the Ascension of Warrior. You got Savage turning baby. Well, Ben turned baby in 87, but Hogan and Savage becoming the Mega Powers. You got the big Boss Man, Kurt Hennig, Mr. Perfect don't start till really the end of the year.
Duggan comes back, Big Duggan Andre feud.
Yeah, I mean,
Jake Andre.
There's stuff going on, but I just like 87 better, I guess, you know, because it's like a more variety going on there.
Yeah, it seems like more of a less structured thing, and you know, I like structure in wrestling, but sometimes I do like it when it's just shit house and you don't know what's gonna happen next. So, speaking of which, we demand Ric Flair must wrestle UWF champion Steve Williams now. 1987 NWA was all over the fucking place.
Oh, Jesus.
I mean, I haven't watched much of it lately. I'm trying to piece my way through some 1987 stuff, but I enjoyed it a lot as a kid. I was still very much an NWA fan, but as a kid, it was tough for me to understand how fast things were happening. Like the Canadian Kodiak Thrin one.
You didn't have TBS, so you missed a lot of stuff on that.
Yeah, we had Power Pro Wrestling and we had Worldwide Wrestling. So I loved catching both of those shows because it was both two very different feeling shows, but there was just so much people. Some would be on both shows. There was the UWF, there was the Florida Purchase, there was Central States. Everything all just turned into one big fucking clusterfuck. And while I think Dusty did a pretty good job with it, and honestly, there was some fucking heavy angles that he started up in 87 and got going, but God, it was a lot. They took on a lot because he had to figure out left from right and who's going to get pushed, who's not. Certain people came up and down the card. We all thought we were going to get the Lightning Express against the what, the Midnight Express or Tully and Arn, and we thought we'd get Doc and Flair. And we never got any of that shit. Black Bart beats Sting on a house show. And it's just like, what's happening? Everything's now in one NWA company under that umbrella. And I was a big Terry Taylor, Eddie Gilbert, Dick Murdoch fan. I love that contingent. And they were rendered pretty useless pretty quickly, despite the fact they were featured. But like, you know, Nikita won. They were gone. The Freebirds never really got over in the NWA in 87. Well, like, I
yeah, they left. No, Hayes, yeah. Hayes the only one to stay.
Yeah,
and then he left in January.
Yeah, and then he did that big World Class 88 run in early.
He left because of the pay. You know, he felt like he wasn't getting paid enough. As he was in a, you know, about in a World Tag Team Title feud with Jimmy against fucking Arn and Tully.
Yeah,
it was just he wasn't getting paid right.
Because I remember it was like Road Warriors, Nikita, Sting, Lex, Dusty. Dr. Death. They had such
a roster.
Ridiculous roster of like powerhouse baby faces. Like, where's Jarrett the Tailbill wants? Where's the blowjob? But like, it was ridiculous because you had so many big, gigantic, husky, ripped, jacked gym rat guys who were just going to rip the horsemen's heads off. But there was so many of them. And it's like, the heel side wasn't as stacked, in my opinion. I mean, you had the Varsity Club, you had the Horsemen.
Well, Varsity Club's after that. That's in 88.
Fuck, then you didn't even have that.
Heels are the Horsemen, Midnight, Paul Jones's crew, Ivan and the Powers of Pain. And then you got on the UWF side, you know, Taylor, Hot Stuff. You got Murdoch in there. So you got some good heels, but the Bayface side definitely was top heavy. Absolutely.
Yeah, it was stacked as 87 and 88 was like my peak fandom as far as like.
And they brought Larry. Larry Zbyszko came in. That was
FZ's in. Yeah. We haven't mentioned Barry Windham, but Barry was on the good guy side.
Yeah, Barry's a face. Yeah, I mean, him and Dr. Death both Bayfaces in that Starrcade match.
Yep, Garvin's are still kicking around. Kevin Sullivan's there. It's like a whole fucking.
The big mistake, and I always point to this in that feud, is they should have did the feud where you had the baby, like the Crockett baby faces were going against UWF heels on the Crockett shows. UWF faces were going against Crockett heels on the UWF shows. That's the way you do that feud. It's so easy.
Yeah, and Dusty just was very profound about it. He's like, fuck them. He's like, we won. We're the Cowboys. We won the Super Bowl. They didn't. Fuck them. And I'm like, damn. But, like, you know, you all bought them. But, you know, I see what he's saying. And, you know, I'll say it till I'm blue in the face. Dusty's loyalty to his fucking guys, whether it's Bart and Ron Bass or Rocky King or Sam Houston or the Horsemen or whomever. You know, for as egotistical and self-centered as everyone said Dusty was, he fucking put in for his guys that were in the trenches with him. So that's why the feud never happened. I'm not happy. I wish the feud did happen. But his point of view was, fuck him. We won. So it's like, it's almost like, it's kind of what Vince would have done if they had bought UWF, you know, and they just.
Well, he would have just shut him out of business. Yeah.
Like,
he would have even done an angle. Yeah.
Yeah, he'd have piecemeal brought in everyone at a different time with a new character, which maybe that's something Dusty could have done a little stronger in 87. But who do you think would have won? Dr. Death or Ric Flair in 1987? They're both pictured here with their belts. They both look awesome.
Well, Flair would have won. But it's a shame we didn't get a proper feud. I mean, they did work against each other in 88. I mean, they did have – but that really should have been the – main event of Starrcade 87. It's the NWA champion against UWF champion. And of course, my whole thing was at the beginning, they should have fucking signed DiBiase and built it all the way up and then have Flair and DiBiase at Starrcade to unify the belts.
You know, it's a weird thing with me. I love Dr. Death. I love Ric Flair. Don't love them against each other.
It's not a fit. It's not a great fit.
No, it's not a match. Like, I love Gordy and Flair. And I thought that was a better fit than Doc and Flair because they did have that world-class match that I enjoyed a lot. And I think 85, 84, 85, but like,
yeah.
I don't really jive with Ric Flair against Dr. I jive with Luger, Nikita, Sting, and Flair. You know, but for whatever – I'd like Buddy Landell against Dr. Death more. It's just this weird thing. Maybe it's because of the flatback stuff. I don't know what it is, but it's just not a match.
Hey, some guys don't have the chemistry together.
Yeah, and honestly, that would have saved it if you would have built Doc up as this motherfucking force who still has the UWF belt. Then, you know, it's just all over with. You know, they did have the Florida champion, Mike Rotundo, there, too. They could have done that at Starrcade, but let's – yeah, no.
Just put the fucking belt on Wyndham.
Yeah.
Put the belt on Wyndham and have Flair win them at Starrcade. Why not?
Yeah, you know that I always felt that should have been it. Like, I always felt – God bless Ron Garvin. My good friend Good Helmet was here. He'd be screaming at me, but like
– It was a year too late. If they were going to give Garvin the belt, it would have been 86.
Yeah, and I like the matches with Garvin and Flair, too. Oh, so great. I feel like I'm saying it, but like I do think it needed the juice, and the juice would have been Barry Windham, Ric Flair, don't move to Chicago, do it in Greensboro, end of story.
Oh, God. Like, yeah, and you had the Barry Windham, Ric Flair feud from earlier in the year, and now you have Windham holding the UWF title. He's now a world champion, so now he gets to Flair, and then – Put the double belts on Wyndham. Have Wyndham be the unified champion.
Not only that, do you know what else? You know, this is going to cause big consternation to our audience. I'd have fucking went with Brad Armstrong before Ronnie Garvin. I would have, because you remember they did the angle. Armstrong hit Flair with the Russian leg sweep. Okay, I get it. And we will fight ad nauseum if Phil Schneider's listening to this. I get that some people don't like Brad. But if you put enough steam on Brad Armstrong in 1986 and 87, you will build him to the point where he can get flash wins over all the other horsemen, and he could even fucking beat Flair in a tag match or something, set that fucking match up. I would have enjoyed it more than Ronnie Garvin. No offense to Ronnie Garvin, but we saw how that all turned out. It just didn't fucking work.
Flair and Brad as a program, yes. Brad as the champion?
No, I didn't say champion. Wait, I didn't.
Okay,
say
okay, 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 okay. Yeah, Flair and Brad's a program, absolutely. As a champion,
Heat on Brad from like fall until November, and make Brad mean something in December, and never have Flair even drop the belt to begin with. Is what I'm getting at. And then he beats Brad, but then maybe there's something else for Brad in '88. No,
Flair and Brad as a program, I definitely got no problem with that at all. It's just, I mean, I don't see Brad as the champion, so to speak.
No,
Wyndham as a champion, absolutely. Absolutely at that time.
Yeah. I just think it's always a thing with Brad.
Think about the story. I mean, he had that run with Flair in 87, and then, I mean, early 87, and then at the end of the year, he beats him. He's now the unified world heavyweight champion. I mean, that's a great story.
Yeah, Barry, I don't know. I think Barry he was all, even though he's Dusty's guy, too, seems like Flair had that stronghold, and I get it too, because Flair was awesome.
Well, Flair was Flair had the power and influence, even with Dusty as the booker. So,
So Destruction with Style. It's Brutus the Barber Beefcake putting Johnny V in a sleeper hold and cutting his hair, and now he's going after Dino and Greg the Hammer. This is already boring to talk about. Like, here's the thing. I loved Beefcake and Valentine as a team. Their breakup and subsequent feud, including with the scissors and the barber gimmick, it's not my thing.
No, Johnny Valiant sucked.
Johnny Valiant sucked, did you say?
I never was a fan of Johnny Valiant.
See, I liked Johnny Valiant. I didn't like him. Obviously, everyone is him and Heenan. Obviously, Heenan's better.
I'll say this for Johnny Valiant. Johnny Valiant, at the beginning of his run, was fine. At the 84, 85, even in the Dream Team 86. By the time they do the breakup, he's just, it's get him up on television.
Yeah, I just think Johnny Valiant, he had almost that Albano at the end kind of thing going on, where he would just say shit, and it seemed like he didn't even know what the fuck he was talking about half the time.
I mean, they put him on commentary. I mean, he's him and a Gorilla and Ernie Ladd do their early wrestling challenges, and it's just a total train wreck until they finally decide, and with the right call, let's put Bobby Heenan in this role, and then the rest is history. Yeah. But man, he sucked on commentary. It just he wasn't this.
I didn't mind him. I thought he was okay.
I never really cared for Johnny Valiant that much, but he was fine in the early run. Absolutely,
I liked him more on commentary than you did. I liked him. I hate dispute. I just buried it. But like what I'm saying is, I liked Johnny more. But I think you're right. I think his goose was cooked by like 87. So I see what you're saying. We flip the page now. Wow, a whole bunch of stuff here. It's Sherry Martel going down a slide at a playground. Misty Blue Simmons, as I used to call her, she's shopping for a dress at a boutique in the harbor front of Baltimore.
Oh, is this that thing where they would have like all these pictures of the wrestlers?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Beyond the Square Circle.
Beyond the Square Circle. There we go.
You got to lead me here, Chris. Yes, we're at the Beyond the Square Circle, that cool thing in the middle where they do personality profiles of everyone outside the ring. Dark Journey giving her mother a kiss at the Great American Bash in Charlotte.
Brown Sugar Baby, as Dusty was
saying. Yes, yes. The mom is glad Journey is no longer working for Tully Blanchard. There you go. I watched Scarface last night, Chris. There's not really any kind of connection there, of course, but that movie's pretty intense.
Yes, it
so,
is.
Yeah, Scarface is wild. Remind me of Razor Ramon a lot. I wonder why. I hadn't watched, obviously, I knew all the phrases, but I hadn't watched the movie in its entirety until last night, and holy shit. Like, when it was over, I like needed to like take a drive and like just a quiet drive.
The ending of that film is it's not heartwarming to say the least.
That movie is fucking intense, man. From the chainsaw at the beginning to the conclusion, I was like, holy fuck, I need some water and just to take a ride. Just I had to throw that aside in there. I saw Dark Journey, read Tully Blanchard, thought cocaine, and just went to Scarface. So I apologize.
That was an odd fit. You know, the Dark Journey and Tully Blanchard deal.
I didn't mind it because I read about her in the magazines, but she really seemed like she completely lost any personality that she had in UWF when she got to WCW.
Well, you know,
it's not her fault. I just think they had her say less.
I think it was the wrong. She had been such a strong baby face in UWF that it was just it's like a total miscasting. And she didn't show personality. I mean, it's just total miscasting of what she had just been, you know. Imagine if they would have brought her into Crockett as like as a baby face, you know, valet for somebody to give them that extra oomph, you know, and some type of feud, you know. I mean, I think it would have been good.
They very well could have put her where Baby Doll was with the Warlord and just put them together as Warlord is like a missing link type character, and I think that might have worked. I love Journey though. Journey was cool, man. But I think her mother was really glad when she got away from Tully Blanchard, is what I'm trying to say.
Yes.
In the 80s. So Jimmy Valiant thought he had a long beard until he grabbed the long, cold David Allan Coe's flowing locks. The Boogie Woogie Man bears a striking resemblance to the country and western singer. No, he doesn't, but they both have a lot of hair on their face. That's what we're going to say here. That's the picture of the two wooliest mammoths this side of Dutch Mantel.
You ever seen the video of Dusty singing Johnny Be Good with Dave?
Oh, of course I have. I think I've watched it with him. He loves.
You know, that's not on YouTube at all?
No?
No. I got to put it
on
there.
Good Helmets Dusty Comp.
Yeah, I got to put it up there. It's not on YouTube at all.
Yeah, I think I showed it to Dusty because he called everyone in to watch because he loved all his time on stage. So that was cool. Window Cooley cracks his bullwhip in preparation for a whipping match with Dutch Mantel. So there's that. All right, we're in the middle of the magazine. You know what time it is? Top 10.
Yes.
I got Ric Flair, Hulk Hogan, Lex Luger, Steve Williams, Barry Windham, Western States Champion, Nikita Koloff, Kurt Hennig, God, Hennig's way down, Randy Savage, Mike Rotundo, Jerry Lawler.
That's a nice list.
Yeah, not a bad list. Now we're going to go NWA versus UWF top 10, Ric Flair versus Steve Williams.
Nate.
Lex Luger against Barry Windham.
Barry Windham.
In 88 or 87, I'm going to go with Luger. Ronnie Garvin or Black Bart from Pampa, Texas.
Ronnie.
Nikita Koloff against Dick Murdoch.
Captain Redneck.
Me too. Eddie Gilbert against Dusty Rhodes. That's a fun one. I'm going Dusty in a bunkhouse mash so they get some juice.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I love Daddy, but yeah, dream is dream.
Ooh, here's a cool one. Tully against Chris Adams.
Wow, that's a match right there. I'd love to see that match. I'd go with Tully. Just a little little edge over that, but I go Tully.
Yeah, Chris Adams was still awesome in 87. Terry Gordy against Barry Windham. Oh, this is awesome.
Wait a minute, how's Barry on there twice?
Oh, Barry's in both the UWF and the NWA ratings, so this is all fucked up.
Hey, that's fine. Terry Gordy against Barry Windham would have been awesome. 87, I got to go with Bam Bam.
Man, I just want to see that match. I don't care who wins. That match would have been incredible.
I don't think they ever worked against each other. I could be wrong on that. I don't think they ever did.
No singles. They had those tags, those 80-minute tags in Watts' 92.
They did have the tags, yes.
Yeah. Everyone likes those tags. I don't dislike them, but, man, they weren't – I would have liked it more in 87. Shane Douglas against Mike Rotundo. That's a fucking funny one. I'm going with Mike at that point.
I'll go with Mike, too.
Yeah, I liked him. This is probably right when you start putting on the singlet. Jim Garvin against Rick Steiner. Just put over Garvin. I'm going with Steiner.
This is 87 Jimmy Garvin, so Rick Steiner.
Yeah.
Babyface Jimmy Garvin is really fun at the beginning, but then you automatically see what happens.
Yeah, he lost a lot.
And he blames Dusty for that.
He sure does.
And I understand why. But, I mean,
I've been watching all those Legends of Wrestling, which is the best shit ever on the network. I wish they would have got Garvin and Dusty in the same room. I think that would have been fun. Because I would have liked to see them hash it out, because I think they would have. But Sting against Kevin Sullivan.
Sting.
And this last one, you're going to fucking crack the fuck up. Big Bubba Rogers against Hercules Ayala.
Oh, my God. So Hercules Ayala. Because of WWC. Wow. I'm going to go with Bubba. Barely. I like Hercules Ayala.
So now we're going to do one more. We're going to do Mid-Southern against Continental.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's great.
You're going to love this.
Okay.
All right. 10 versus 10. King Carl Fergie against Robert Fuller.
Oh, the Robert Fuller. Come on. Tennessee Stud.
Jimmy Golden. I go Fuller, too. Jimmy Golden against Billy Joe Travis.
Ooh, Jimmy Golden.
Yeah, he drop kicks Travis right in the face, and Travis takes his crazy flip bump. Not even have the finish. Superstar Bubba against Jonathan Boyd.
Superstar Bubba.
I'm going with Superstar Bubba because I didn't work with Jonathan Boyd's son. Paul Diamond or Steve Armstrong?
Paul Diamond.
Yeah, Paul Diamond was awesome. Ooh, this one's fucking great. Patrick Tanaka against Tom Pritchard.
Ooh. I'm going to go with Tanaka barely.
Me too, and I just wish we got a Bad Company against the Heavenly Bodies. Bobby Jaggers against Tony Anthony. That's a good one.
Dirty White Boy.
Yeah, I picked Tony Anthony also. Scott Armstrong against Bill Dundee. The Bullet against Jeff Jarrett.
Ooh, 87. I'm going to go with Bullet.
Yeah, I got to go with the Bullet in 87. Oh, this next one's so fucking funny. It seems like a match that would have been booked at 1990 Great American Bash. Doug Furness against George Barnes.
Doug Furness.
A lot of fucking horrific styles clash. I was so pissed off that he fought Dutch Mantel with that bash. And I love Dutch, but that they should have just mixed up different people. Speaking of Dutch Mantel against Jerry Lawler.
I tell you, I picked the King, but Dutch, of all the Lawler opponents, Dutch may be the one that's the most underrated. Because they had an amazing series in 82 where both were babyface against each other, and neither one of them never turned heel, but man, it was so fucking great.
I had Dutch against Lawler in the top 10 of my Memphis Project list. I forget what my list was, but I did have that in the top 10. Maybe Mookie has my list. Maybe he saved some of that stuff. I remember writing a lot about that. I like that set. Oh, and the final thing here, Chris, you'll laugh at this. The final match, it all comes down to this. Drum roll. AWA Southern Champion Don Bass against Continental Champion Wendell Cooley.
Wendell. Seeing Cowboy Don Bass is fun, but yeah, Wendell, he's...
Yeah, a little bit of a tepid final there. What else we got here? Oh, a plea for decency. Ric Flair has finally stepped over the line of common decency with this film of his quote-unquote dream date with Precious. If we had a child, we would want him to watch a wrestling show, not a bedroom scene of Flair in a black necktie in a bed getting ready for Precious and J.J. Dillon hiding in the closet like a peeping Tom. What does this have to do with professional wrestling? How things change. There is a time and place for everything, and Jim Crockett should take lessons from Vince McMahon on how to run a classy show.
Think about that.
Yeah. Why can't they stick to wrestling? Why can't Crockett watch what Flair puts on the air? We don't need Flair in Space Mountain. That is Mr. and Mrs. Maxwell Friedlander from Yonkers, New York. There you go. They're very upset.
Well, oh well.
Ooh, I have a question for Terry Taylor. Have you ever considered getting yourself a valet? Someone like Missy Hyatt? Terry Taylor replied, listen. When I come out to the ring, I want people to look at me, not some dime a dozen tramp. Holy shit. Valets are fine for some guys, but they're not my style. I don't want anyone accusing me of winning a match because my valet interfered. If Eddie Gilbert wants Missy in his corner, that's his prerogative. Some guys enjoy showing off their women. I prefer to keep mine behind closed doors. That's a shoot. Holy shit. Well, there's that.
Yeah, he does. He lets his work behind closed doors.
I'm gonna run away from that story. Okay, so what else we got here?
If only they would ask about Kimono Wanalea.
You know what? Don't know nothing about that. Don't need to know anything about that. So as we go, what's happening here? We're closing out the magazine. Holy shit, Chris! We get a good time on these things. What's happening? Continued here. Rip Oliver signed with WWF. He's going to feud with Billy Jack Haynes. Don't remember that happening. Dory Funk still hasn't returned the Florida heavyweight belt that he stole from champion Mike Rotundo. That was a big thing where Terry and Dory came back to Florida to fight with Mike Rotundo in the very dying days of Florida wrestling.
Yeah.
Remember when I met both Wyndham and Taylor Rotunda, I brought up their dad wrestling Dory Funk Jr. over all the other shit I could have brought up. Man, yeah, some good ones, guy. Johnny Ace was recently kidnapped by Blackjack Mulligan and Bugsy McGraw. We have the proof here in this incriminating photograph. It's a picture of Johnny Ace being tied up and thrown into a trunk of a fucking car, which is way more horrifying now than it probably was then. So there's that. Wendi Richter is defending her WWC women's title against Rhonda Singa. That's their spelling. And Peggy Lee.
Peggy Lee Leather, yes.
Oh, here we go. This is sad. This hit me fucking hard at the time. In Yarmouth, England, Malcolm King Kong Kirk died in the ring on August 24th during a match against veteran Big Daddy Crabtree. The 336-pound Crabtree, who was in charge of the match at the 10-minute mark when he slammed Kirk, moved in with a big splash. After splashing and pinning Kirk, the ring doctor and several medics ran in the ring when they noticed Kirk wasn't moving. They tried for 15 minutes to revive him but were unsuccessful. Holy shit. See, that was so much scarier as a kid because they made it seem like Malcolm King Kong Kirk died from a move, which I guess maybe he did, but I'm assuming he went into cardiac arrest.
Yeah. He had a heart attack and died, yeah.
That was the first in-ring wrestling death I think I ever remember hearing about.
Yeah, sad.
Was Malcolm King Kong Kirk a big guy? Because I always dreamed
of
him.
Yeah, he was big. He was a big dude. Yeah.
Ooh, okay, final thing here. Gags and novelties. This is where Rob O'Connor might want to turn the volume up. All right, Chris, I'm going to get this show's really going off the rails. I'm going to give you two gags and novelties. You have to pick between the two what one you would purchase.
All right.
And I'll do the same. A telescope with a tripod, plastic durable 395. Use this telescope night or day. Magnify several times the original size. Fantastic value. This looks like a complete piece of shit in the picture, but we're just going to say that. Or spectacular optical illusion. Imagine having X-ray eyes and seeing through things. These wonderful specs and the amazing ability of producing the illusion of seeing through things. One pair for $395, and they show some creepy fucking guy staring through a woman's clothes. So for this one, I'm going to go with the telescope and tripod, which is
oh, I want see-through vision. Oh, that's
yeah, I mean. But I think neither one of these things going to fucking work, but we're going to go with the telescope with the tripod, Chris, for me.
Okay.
The next one, badges. A choice of 6 different badges, Chris. That'd be really over nowadays. You can be a security card badge, a deputy sheriff badge, a special police badge, special officer badge like Todd Champion had. You can be a private detective badge or a spec investigator badge. This is $9.50. You got to indicate what kind of badge you would like, or on the other end, motherfucking sea monkeys, Chris. Hatch live sea monkeys in minutes. All you do is put them in water and watch the entire family spring to life. They make great pets. And you have a bunch of monkeys in a little monkeys in a glass. So I'm going to go with sea monkeys.
I'll go with the badge. So, special investigator.
Yes, there you go. You even picked your badge. Good job. I'm going to go with sea monkeys because they're clearly bullshit, I'm assuming.
Yeah, got like, it. Yeah, it's just...
I still don't know what a sea monkey is. It's kind of fucked up. And I think I know someone who drank them once, but we're just going to end it at that. Two things here. A poo-poo cushion made to last. Great at parties. Brings out the best in people. Will not break. It's a fun thing. $2.95 for the poo-poo cushion. It shows a woman sitting in a chair and it goes poo-poo. It's a whoopee cushion, guys. Or, you know what I'm going to pick on this one? Be taller. Lifts add height. Be more macho. Adds easily slip into the shoes to add height. Completely invisible. $3.95 of the best cents I will ever spend. I'm going with the be taller lifts.
I'll do that too, because I mean, I never go to the kid for the cushions.
Yeah, the whoopee cushion gimmick. I don't get that. No. Oh, shit. Last one. It's a good one. Toucan drinking helmet. Uh-huh. Ideal for sports events, rock concerts, and just plain fun. Your hands are free, and you could drink through our extra long straw. Holds 2 cans of any beverage. Completely adjustable, one size fits all. And it shows some dumb fuck with the fucking helmet on his head with 2 beers and 2 straws coming down from it. Or you could pick this one. That one's going to be $9.95, by the way. The other one, a squirting toilet. Watch the fun when unsuspected friends open up the lid of our trick squirting toilet. Presto! Cold stream of water squirts right in the face. Everyone's favorite gag. $4.95. All right. I'm going to go with a squirting toilet just because I'd enjoy the day. And I guess that's the use that I will use of it. And the toucan drinking helmet, I can't see myself wearing one of those.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Absolutely. All right. We thought that was the end, but oh no, there's more. The final page of the magazine in color. It's the Gentleman Chris Adams International Fan Club.
I remember that.
Oh, yeah, you get an 8x10 glossy photo. You get a personal biography of Chris Adams. I think they're going to leave out a flight or two in 86. 4 to 6 newsletters a year. All the fun stuff happening in Chris Adams land. Official fan club button. Buttons were over in the 80s, guys. An official fan club membership card. Oh, my God, guys, if you're listening to this, you have one of these, please post it. If this happens, by the way, I'll also give you $100. I don't think it's going to happen. 10% discount on all exclusive fan club souvenirs. And there's a bunch of posters, Chris Adams, and a handkerchief.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was definitely hustling back then, for sure. So,
ooh, a satin jacket, Chris.
Oh, yeah.
Adams, white satin jacket. $60 to non-members, and the members a cool $54.
I remember Michael Hayes was selling his satin jackets for that album. Was it Off the Streets? Off the Streets, yeah. I wanted one of those.
I did too. I wanted any kind of satin jacket. I wish I could find my San Antonio Spurs satin jacket that I had years ago. I probably still fucking fit in it, let's face it. So, like, yeah, I'd like to have it. I hear satin jackets are kind of making a soft comeback.
So they came back not that long ago. Starter made a comeback. Yeah, absolutely.
That's good. I support that. I think all things satin. I saw satin pants and Martin. Purple satin pants with the Martin logo on them. So oh, that was, wow. That's a trip. I sent that to one Mr. Stokely Hathaway immediately. This is keen to your interest, my friend. But yeah, that's it for our show here, guys. That was The Wrestler from December 1987. Quick and painless as per usual with cover to cover here with me and Chris.
Absolutely. So good times, good times.
Yes, and we will be back, and Chris Zellner will be choosing our magazine of choice next time.
Yeah, no idea yet what that will be, but we'll try to go somewhere. I might go into the 90s this time, so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, we have finally started cataloging our shows, by the way.
Yes, yes. We make sure that we don't pick the same magazine twice.
Yeah, guys, I'm Polish and blonde, so, like, I honestly thought I was going to pick the same magazine at least twice now. So out of the thousands that I have, I've literally been like, did we already do this once? So now we have a list, so we'll be trying to incorporate that to make it a little bit different every time. So
yeah, so, yeah, we'll see what happens on the next show. But anyway, great show, Rob, as always.
Yeah, I thought so, too.
And, yeah, so we'll be back in a month or so, and we'll have those shows. So, Rob, we'll throw it to you to close it out.
All right, I'm not as good as Chris at this, but thank you all for listening. Hope you had a wonderful July 4th that has happened after the show. And enjoy the rest of your summer. We'll catch up with y'all in August. So, adios from the Keystone State of Pennsylvania. Take care. Black and white.